And so I respected him and I liked him as a person. And so he was like, oh, I was very paisey. You know, I was very embarrassed to ask you for money. I don't want to ask for friends. I want a family. I want to ask from strangers. And I was like, whoa, let me get in. And so I managed to kind of get some education.
Oh, so there's many your reputation, actually, in this case, it didn't help you, right?
Because it didn't help me.
As a friend, he feels paisey to ask you, although you're the most obvious person that he should be asking. Yeah, and you're actually interested to invest.
Okay. And, I was just like,
tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Chill with TFC. This is a show where we talk to the quirkiest and geekiest minds to find out how they think about money and life. My name is Andrew and today I'm chilling with Jeremy Au. He has a podcast, it's called Brave, Southeast Asia Tech. And Jeremy is also a VC at Monk Hill Ventures, where he sculpts and nurtures the businesses that might transform our lives. Jeremy is also a serial founder and angel investor in over 20 startups across Asia, which is why on today's episode, we'll be putting him and his Harvard MBA to the test to answer this question. Should you invest in your friends and family's businesses? And don't forget to stay till the end for our Money Insight segment to learn what Jeremy's best and worst investments are. Congrats on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a pleasure writing a book, Brave 10, the Singapore edition. It's an anthology of inspiring journeys across Southeast Asia and Singapore tech. So it was nice to be able to donate the profits to charity, but it was helpfully inspire the next generation of founders.
Yeah, so it's stories about founders and you as a VC, you've worked with several founders, you talk to them. So today we're going to talk about something rather interesting about whether you should invest in your friends and family's businesses. And if on the flip side, you're trying to raise funds from your friends and family, like how should you go about doing it? What's your personal experience with that? When you started your business back then, now you're more VC, if I'm not wrong. Yeah. Or when you started, like, have you raised funds from friends and family before? Yeah. Or you went straight to the VC route?
Well, you know, I've been, you know, obviously a student, a soldier in national service. I've also been a management consultant. And then after that, I built two companies, which was one was a social enterprise. And the second was being a VC-backed startup, right? From zero to pre-seed, a seed, a series A. To eventually sail before finally becoming a VC. And so I think it's been interesting to really have that experience of, you know, fundraising twice, you know, one a social enterprise, one a for-profit education tech business. And both experiences were quite eye-opening because I think it really shows you what you had to be prepared for. And obviously the understandable concerns that people have, right? Because they're entrusting you to do something crazy, which is to build up a new business. Yeah, exactly. I mean, setting up a business is crazy if you think about it, right? I mean, in today's world, you know, there's so many stable jobs. There's so many like steady paychecks. Why set up a business, right? And I think being able to create a business that encapsulates that change to the status quo is difficult. And I think it's understood rightfully by the market that it's difficult, right? There's a high chance of failure.
Odds of failure is high.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, give us betting on your paycheck. Like, how much would I pay for your next month paycheck? I know exactly how much it's going to be. But would your company be around in 1 year? You know, that's a very tough question all the time.
What's the difference between raising funds from VCs and raising funds from friends and family?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the
is interesting, it easier or in fact harder?
Which side, you know? Well, I think first of all, the fundamental question is what kind of business are you building, right? So are you building a technology startup that has that pathway and mechanism to eventually become $1 billion company? And when you say $1 billion company, it means on average, it means that you're generating $100 million of revenue and having a public market multiple of 10x, right? So 100 mil revenue per year times 10 equals $1 billion company. And are you planning to do that within 10 years, right? And if you say yes to all those things, then you should go to venture capital because they are there and looking for people like you who have the ambition and hopefully the capability to be able to do that within that time frame. For everybody else who is building a business, maybe you're thinking about slow and steady, you're thinking about more of a lifestyle, sustainable business, or you're looking for a business that generates cash flow, then the VC route is not really there for you. That being said, both of these types of companies we'll often start out with family and friends first. And I think that was my experience starting out, because at the end of the day, you're explaining, I think, two different things, right? One is why the world needs this solution, which is, I think, the very intellectual piece. And the second part is why I am building this product, right? The founder market fit. Why do I care about this thing? And so there's a very interesting dynamic where across your family and friends who is listening to you, they are definitely processing that, right? Which is, do I believe that the world needs this? And do I believe that you can actually build this? Because at that moment, when you're out raising money from family and friends, normally it's a very small check. It could be $50,000, $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, you know. But that quantum, as you kind of work through family who know you best, right, to your friends, to your friends of friends, to your friends and friends of friends, is often quite a journey for many people. And I think it's a painful journey.
Yeah. And you brought up the point about, is it a tech startup that 10x in 10 years, or is it like a cafe they're opening? I mean, it's a very different story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for the cafe, if you're running a restaurant or something, then yeah, maybe friends and family, it's a starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a VC, have you heard of any horror stories from the founders who raised funds from friends and family and things really didn't work out well?
Yeah, often actually. And I think it's a very common, because the truth is almost every founder for both types of businesses, VC backable slash with ambition to become a unicorn or even a lifestyle business, I think there's a real dynamic where everyone's a first-time founder often. And so they often don't necessarily understand what is the best parameters for what they're trying to build. And what that means is that they're not necessarily thoughtful about, say, the legal contracts that it is a legal agreement, even if it's your family or friends. It is actually a fiduciary responsibility of yours, because you're saying, I'm going to do this and therefore I need Y cash. And sometimes it's not necessarily clear from the founder side, because they think they're executing about what they promise, but it's not necessarily clear. And then family and friends get frustrated, they get angry, get emotional, which is very fair. Or vice versa, you know, the founder has been clear, but because it's not documented, then there are claims by the family and friends to be like, you know, I deserve more. Or, and this even is even in the best case scenario where the company is successful, right? Because everybody wants a share of it. You know, what happens? The truth is most companies fail, right? I mean, heck, if you even look at VC-backed companies, 95% of companies will fail. The system is designed for 95% of the startups that to not do well. And I think when the money goes to zero, then I think it can be a very difficult situation for founders who obviously are going through the loss and grief of losing the business they've been building. But also I think it's a very personal, emotional and financial pain for whoever chose to invest in that initial friends and family round.
Can I say that whether it's friends and family or VCs, you should treat them all as investors, right? They get all the investor updates. You should sign up all the agreements right from the start. So how should you structure as a founder? How should you structure it such that, you know, you protect yourself from such horror stories?
You know, I think the first is, you know, self-awareness about what you're building. And if you're clear about whether you're building more of a lifestyle or cash flow business versus a VC-backed business. And I'll talk about the second category more, because I think that's an increasingly common path that's viable for Southeast Asians and Singaporeans to do.
And a lifestyle cash flow business would mean something like a
cafe, bookstore, but something that you see, you know, even a cleaning business. You imagine that, you know, stepwise, a chronological way. I think for that, obviously, normally, you know, people are buying a normal share, you know, percentage of the shareholdings. There's a relatively fair price that you hopefully set, and you don't sell too much of the company, for example. But the truth is, you know, your access to capital is a function of demand and supply, right? You know, supply in terms of capital, how well off your network is, and demand, right? Which is in that sense, like how much capital do you need and how good are you at fundraising from your friends and family? So, you know, those quantums we've seen, you know, people have a very robust debate, which is like, is this cafe worth, before it begins, X million dollars or whatever, right? And it can be very emotional. And I think it's a very tough conversation.
Yeah, how do you evaluate? I mean, both parties are going to have different point of view about it, right?
Yeah, and I think that's where I think on the good thing about the VC pathway is that there's a lot of mechanisms these days that honestly kick the can down the road at one level, but also I think let more informed people make that representation and valuation later. So what I mean by that is that if you look at venture capital or VC-backed startups, what the instrument that founders normally use is they use something called a safe note or convertible debt. But what it fundamentally says is that you know, we put the money in and there will be a valuation exercise that'll be done in the next 2 years, for example. And the price of that will be set then in the future. Mm. And between now and then, the price that we have right now will be a function of a discount versus that future. Mm. So for example, we don't know whether this magic box that has something inside, we don't know what value is. We don't know it's worth $100 or $1 million. We don't know, right? Box, yeah. It's a black box, right? Mm. And because it's a VC-backed startup, it has the promise to be $1 million. Unlike normal lifestyle business, it's either $100 or $150. So the variance is very low. Mm. But because the variance is high between 100 versus $1 million, then the instrument basically says, when this box is opened up in 2 years, I will be able to earn 20% or 30% or 10% more with my cash check in terms of value versus the future. So in 2 years, my money check today and the money that comes in 2 years will all be converted at the same time.
Mm. And that's called a safe note or a convertible debt. They mean the same thing?
Yeah, they are relatively interchangeable. Okay. Safe is a form of convertible debt, which is more founder friendly, but not all convertible debt is a form of safe, right? Okay.
Ding, ding. Safe note stands for Simple Agreement for Future Equity, SAFE. Simple Agreement for Future Equity. These notes are documents that act as a legally binding promise to allow an investor to purchase a specified number of shares for an agreed-upon price at some point in the future.
I mean, whatever I know is from Shark Tanks. And the sharks will say, I'll buy a business for 20% at this amount. So does it work like that? Equity model in which I invest X amount of money for X amount of equity?
No. Yeah, friends and family would normally, and I normally recommend a safe note because I think that's safer for everybody. Because you don't want family to have bought in too cheap. Neither would you want them to have bought in too expensive, right? Because you're buying too cheap, they feel left out and you feel bad about it. If it was too expensive, then you feel you lost control, you lost equity shareholding, they felt unfair. So I think a convertible debt helps a lot. For Shark Tank, unfortunately, I think that's how most people think friends and family are, because it's a show designed for friends and family. So the people who are watching Shark Tank are people who are like, oh, I too can be a shark. Yeah. So forth. And, I think there's an unfortunate reality where I think it's done a tremendous job educating people about the fact that people next door, your neighbor, your friend can set up a business that's amazing, right? And spotting talent is a great exercise. Mm. At the same time, I think I've noticed that sometimes friends and family take away the wrong parameters because these Shark Tank folks are not friends and family and you should not be acting like them. These are billionaires or millionaires. They're acting, frankly, as investors. They're acting more like venture capitalists and they pretend to have that, you know, some of them have the more of that aura, some of them more adversarial. And so I think it's a shame if you as a friend or family are taking on that same aggressive stance as a Shark Tank judge or investor.
Okay, yeah. So if you take the flip side of the table, if you are a friend and family, someone is coming up to you. So what should your considerations be? And you mentioned you don't have to be like a shark because that's literally your friend asking you for help with his or her business. So how should you come in? What should your approach be?
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, the awkward reality, and I mentioned this earlier, is that you have to suddenly make an assessment about your drinking buddy, old army buddy, right, your sister or brother, right?
I mean,
your uncle. Yeah. I mean, so you're making this evaluation, you just hang out with them for, you know, some holiday or Christmas. And suddenly you have to sit back and you say, wait, I need to reevaluate this and say, okay, you know, I like them as a person. I'll trust them, my kids, you know.
They're good to have a drink with.
They're good to have a drink with. Yeah. And you're like, wait a moment. Like, and you have that make assessment, which is this the business that makes sense, right? And that's one level. And the second one is, do I trust this person to make that business happen? And those are two very separate questions, right? So first of all is, does this business make sense, right? And that's a tough one because the truth is when a friend or family comes in, you know, they may be doing stuff like, you know, I literally have a friend and he is doing immunotherapy for cancer, right? He's building gene and immunotherapy basically to trick your body's immune system to attack cancer. The science is difficult. The path is hard. Funding is difficult for that kind of startup. But the truth of the matter is that if he makes it happen, it's definitely a $1 billion company because nobody wants to have cancer and everybody is going to face cancer at some point of time.
It's going to help people.
And it's going to help people. But the thing is, you suddenly have to say to yourself, like, wait, how much do I understand about the science? How much do I understand about the business? How much do I understand about what the market is, right? And that may be very non-obvious, to be honest, right? I mean, you look at Facebook, right? Mark Zuckerberg basically got money from his dad, and he was basically saying, here's a social network for you, university kids. And so you can sit down yourself and be like,
is that going to be...
you think about it today. It's like, imagine if someone comes up to you and say, like, you know, I want to create a video ad where people can scroll for fun. Yeah. And you're like, and then... You know, 10 years later, it's TikTok, right? And you're like, wait, there's a lot of video apps. There's YouTube, there's Facebook, there's Google. So I think it's really non-obvious. And so the ability to assess that really helps you there. And I think self-awareness, right? I mean, you know, are you an investor by background? Are you an operator in that field? Do you have experience in that domain? Are there friends you can ask to learn about that space? I think it's a very important one. And the second, you know, below the iceberg, below the waterline, is really like, do you trust this person to solve that problem? And sometimes people use it as a proxy. What I mean by that is like, oh, this person is super capable, super smart, super trustworthy. And so I don't understand the business, but I trust him as a person.
Right.
I think that's not a bad proxy, I think. But I think it can go badly as well sometimes, because they can be earnest and smart and capable, but the truth is they haven't done homework, or they got too excited, or that's actually a lot harder than they think it is, right? And so the proxy may be adequate for you trusting the person, but not adequate for it to be the outcome. And the worst case, and I think the huge issue at the end of the day is, you know, it's very, very hard to cognitively say something like, oh, I really trust this person to take care of my kid. And but I don't trust this person to run the business and to give $20,000, right? Because it's not easy. I mean, it's not even about a person. It's just fundamentally saying, like, it's not like saying whether this person can do well in an exam or not, right? You know, which is a binary basis, right? Between 100 to 0. It's literally an exam where in a VC back world, 95% is going to fail. It's like, you know, you're like...
And luck plays a part.
Yeah, and luck plays a part too. And so I think it's a very fair piece to be like, hey, you know, I'm not making a decision to spend 1 hour of time, which is a knob thing. But it's almost like a binary thing, which is like, you either succeed or you fail, right? And so I think that's a tricky conversation to have, not just with them in a way that preserves a relationship over the time, but also a tricky conversation to have internally.
Learning how to differentiate the person as a businessman as compared to him or her being your friend.
Yeah, it's tough. And how do you even say deliver the news, right? It's like, you know, I like you as a friend, but I don't trust you as a businessman. That's awkward.
Good luck with that.
I mean, yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's honestly easier to do.
I'm rooting for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the truth is often the opposite is easier, right? It's easier to be like, oh, I like you as a businessman. I don't like you as a person. I mean, that's the most common thing.
At least,
right?
You can make money from me, right?
Yeah, exactly. And people do that all the time. You know, like they go in public markets and they invest in, you know, companies. They look at Shark Tank and you're like, oh, this guy makes money, even though I don't like the person, right? And so I think there's an interesting dynamic where I think it can be a very difficult conversation to have.
How do you assess? Have you ever said no to a friend and family?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, I think the way to have the conversation, frankly, is I think to share and really keep on the business. So say like, hey, you know, putting aside our history, et cetera, like here's my questions about the business, and having that fair and open discussion to be like, hey, I want to really hear what you are thinking about it. I want to hear what you need help on. I want to know what we should work on together if this was to happen. And I think in that discussion, the process, what it should come out is at the end of that entire process, be it 1 hour, 2 hours, 5 hours, 10 hours, both sides already know what the answer is going to be because of the way that you have been thoughtful about asking questions. And, you know, you almost want it to be like to the point where you're like, yeah, you know, the other person understands why you're not investing rather than just a decision that you're not investing.
That could be useful information for them.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, it's useful information for them to maybe improve their pitch at one level, or it could be useful information for them to improve or tweak
the business model itself.
Exactly. Yeah. Or maybe it's useful feedback for them to say, you know what, this is not the right idea. I'm going to think of a different idea or do something different, right? And I think that can be a very helpful conversation both ways.
I'm sure you get a lot of these because you're a VC yourself, your friends and family. You're going to be their top of mind when they want to raise some funds.
Always top of mind. And I think it's a privilege, right? Because it means that I think people trust you and people think that you have the capital to do that. And people want you to be part of the team. And so I think when people ask you, it's very much a gift of, because it's tough to ask for capital, right? You know, I've been in that shoe, right? It's like, oh, I need to ask for money. And so, but actually you're also gifting them with the opportunity to invest in you. And vice versa, I think that when someone gives you the gift of being vulnerable for capital, but also being brave enough to try to build something new, I think you have to be a good steward in being kind. So it doesn't mean that you're not unwise. It doesn't mean that you're not being savvy. It's just that you can do all those things about being thoughtful about a business model while also being kind to the person, right? And the truth is, hopefully you also are just as kind to a stranger asking you for capital. But the truth is, the awkward reality is that you have a pre-existing relationship with friends and family that you don't have with a stranger, right? Mm-hmm. And so the stranger often will have an easy come, easy go because there's no hard feelings dynamic. But for friends and family, it can feel personal. And so being kind is really big.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So after you've done asking the right questions, you've done your due diligence and you decided to invest, how do you, can I use the word negotiate when it comes to your friends and family? Yeah. So how do you like negotiate a deal?
Oh, I mean, that's a good one. You know, I always remember that I had a good friend in Boston and, you know, he was a neighbor of mine. We're both Singaporeans, founders, and I started first and we're in a building, etc. And I remember for him, he was very much like, at some point he was like, oh, I'm closing the round, the financial round. And I was like, wait, I want to invest. I was like,
what? You're already closing?
You're already closing? He's a friend. Uh-huh. Yeah, but I really respected him too, right? And he'll be someone that I would ask him for advice and he would ask me for advice. And so I respected him and I liked him as a person. And so he was like, oh, I was very paisey. You know, I was very embarrassed to ask you for money. I don't want to ask for friends. I want a family. I want to ask from strangers. And I was like, whoa, let me get in. And so I managed to kind of get some allocation. He did me a solid, you know, got some allocation for me.
Oh, so that's when your reputation actually, in this case, it didn't help you, right?
Because it didn't help me.
As a friend, he feels paisey to ask you, although you're the most obvious person that he should be asking. Yeah, and you're actually interested to invest.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, I was just like, okay. You know, I have to do, right? Mm. And then, you know, obviously it was a small check, you know, so something that I felt was within my budget and my capital liquidity. And it's
so how does it work? It's the last round and, you know, it's a small amount. Like.
Yeah, because, you know, a certain amount that he's raising, let's just say $1 million. And, you know, he's collected money from all these other people and professionals. And then he's like, oh, okay, you know, this has some space left for you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it was, in that case, for example, I followed the terms because the other professional investors are ahead of me with much larger checks. And so they get to decide parameters and the control rights and the financial terms of the round. And I'm just following. So in this case, I was like more of a follower. Sometimes it's the opposite. You're like the first check that someone to for someone else. Yeah, so
do valuations. And
I think that's very tricky because what you can say maybe is like, and this often happens, is I'm willing to put some capital and I'll follow along with someone else, a more professional investor to set the terms and so forth. Or sometimes the founder already has a point of view and they pretty much set the terms, right, of the round. And you get to evaluate it, not just as the company and the person, but you get to evaluate whether the deal is attractive, right? Mm. Because sometimes the truth is, if the founder sets very attractive deal terms, if it's a lifestyle business, a cash flow business, if it's a business that you're not sure about, maybe the deal terms are attractive enough to you're like, yeah, you know, I'll still go in. But it's not an easy process. And the awkward reality is that, you know, most investors should be in public equities. Mm. Most people should have enough, you know, capital for rainy day fund and insurance and, you know, cover your rent or mortgage. And hopefully when you've done all of that, then you have some, you know, sophistication inherent to be able to make that piece. And I think that when you do that investment as well, being thoughtful to be like, hey, you know, really being thoughtful about the quantum, really being something in an amount that you can lose. And it's not easy to say, but I think it's a very high chance of failure, right? I said 95% chance if you're a professional VC looking at startups. So your friends and family, you know, you're not a professional. You may not be looking at thousands of startups in the same, you know, hierarchy.
You're not a VC, right?
So then maybe your odds are worse. Maybe it's only 1% for a VC-backed startup, right? Of course, you know, what the reward is supposed to be is that if it's 5% or 1%, you know, the returns are not just 100x, it's like 1,000 or 10,000x. Mm. But I think that's really, I think, the fundamental struggle for a lot of folks. And so it's not for everyone. So definitely kind of normally size your first checks to be quantums that you feel ready to lose or not have. Yeah. So one thing to be thoughtful about is when do you expect the investment to be able to bear fruit or mature as an investment? So for example, obviously if you're in the stock markets, you can invest in an ETF today and then there's enough liquidity often that if there are gains the next day, then you can extract that out, right? And so it's a function of both the understanding of when the underlying value or asset goes up as a gain and also the ease of being able to pull that out. So what's interesting is that when you invest in your friends or family's business, you have to be thoughtful about when you expect these gains to happen and also the ease of being able to get them out. So for example, if you're investing in a friends or family, cash flow business, then often what you're doing is that you're investing in them and maybe within a year or even a half a year, they could already be returning profitable cash flow or 2 years or 3 years. And then often you're being paid dividends or some level of cash flow back. So that investment as a result is much easier for you to understand because you're like, I put in $10,000 and hopefully I'll get a share and maybe I get $1,000 per year starting from 2 years out. That's the plan there. However, for technology startups are very different because when you're putting money in, as often as the first or second round of capital, what's happening is that you're actually saying, I'm expecting this company to become a $1 billion company within the next 10 years. And that's what their goal ambition is. And what that means is that, again, there's a 95% chance of failure along that pathway. And on top of that, is that the gains that happen at each stage are all people gains. So they're valued at $1 million, $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion. But they may not be generating free cash flow because that cash is being reinvested back in the business. So you're not going to receive dividends and you're only going to receive, hopefully, a probability adjusted chance of that paper valuation being unlocked at an exit in 10 or 12 or 15 years, right? And so suddenly, you suddenly think to yourself, okay, at level one, probability of failure, 90 to 95%. Two is there's very rapid gains, but they're all paper. And so it's not going to be distributed to me in the meanwhile. And therefore, there are paper gains until then. And I can't use paper gains to, eat. Yeah, exactly. Eat or go to the bank or get a loan or do these things. It's just locked up there forever for, this entire time. And thirdly, the exit can only happen at a qualified liquidity event, which is often an IPO or trade sale, which happened in 10 or 15 years. And so, even as having that rapid thing, actually maybe a shorter term financial instrument, maybe a better return on investment for you personally than, this fast growth but highly illiquid investment is. So I think it kind of doubles back on our earlier point, which is that when you invest in a friend's technology startup, you should expect the baseline to be zero because in the worst case scenario, it does go to zero, which is also the base case for 90-95%. Mm-hmm. But in the best case scenario, it's a 10, 100, 1,000x multiple, but it's all paper for 10 to 15 years, right? Which means that you're like in your 30s and you're going to see that in your 45, yeah. Right? That's forever.
There's this term which is raising money from the three Fs,
yeah.
Friends, family, and fools. So the way I interpret it is that, it's kind of like a joke because, you raise money from your friends, family first and they are the fools because they're the ones who believe in you because they know you personally. Like, do you think that's true? Do you think there's some truth to this statement? Friends, family, and fools.
It's a good question because anyone can be a fool, right? The founder can be a fool, the friend can be a fool, the family can be a fool. But I think what it's trying to describe is a certain sense that it's easy to get capital from friends, families, and fools, right? So what I mean by that is your parents, or your siblings, or your extended family, they're all going to put in a check. So family is an easy one to get some quantum, right? And friends who know you for some time, it's easy to get that capital.
Even a small amount, right?
A small amount, right? 1,000, 2,000, and it all stacks up. Mm. And the fools are like, people who are like, it's crazy for them to invest in you because they don't know you, they don't know the business, and they may not necessarily be sophisticated, right? So I think that's a very mercenary way, I think, sometimes to think about that capital because it's really talking about the easiness of getting capital.
Yeah.
But I think from take a step out, I think at the end of the day, as a founder, you want to take capital from people who are going to help you get there. And you want to make them money because by making them money, you're also making money for yourself, right? Because a successful business means that they get a high return. And so I think the tricky part is you have to talk to family and not take advantage of that relationship and just be say, these are the risks, these are the rewards, this is what I'll do and this is what I'll try to steward that dynamic. To your friends, I think you also have that same level of rigor. And for fools or strangers, you should also have the same level of integrity and frankness about the risks and the rewards, right? And I think what that hopefully causes is like, you know, instead of, you know, an x-axis like friends, family, and fools, you kind of also have the y-axis, which is like, are they sophisticated and helpful versus not, right? And, you know, that category of sophisticated, helpful friends, family, and strangers can really be aligned with your vision of the company and also avoid control disputes on the road, financial disputes on the road, but also accelerate the business in a meaningful way.
You know, there's this saying about lending friends money, and I'm not talking about the context of building a business, but more like your friend wants to borrow $1,000 to $2,000 from you. And they tell you, okay, if you want to borrow, lend money to your friend, take it that never getting it back. So do you think that should be the same mindset that should be applied, you know, when you invest in a friend's or family's business?
Yeah, I think so.
Odds of failure are high. So, like, you know, I put the money in, okay, don't expect to get it back. If it works out, it works out.
I mean, I think the difference is that when I normally lend a friend for money, sometimes it's like because, you know, they have cash flow requirements, right? Like they need a mortgage or they can't meet because they are going through a job transition or they have, you know, health bills to deal with, right? And so I think lending people cash is almost predictable. It's like you kind of know what the salary is at a high level in ballpark. And you know that the cash requirements are also there, right? And it's relatively predictable. So that conversation, the parameters are more inbound. And so I think that's why you kind of say like, you know, you may not get it back, right? What's interesting about investment is that there's an element of greed, right? And fear of missing out, right? So what I mean by that is there's greed in the sense that you think that this person can make a lot of money, right? And you don't want to miss out. And then sometimes you hear that other people are putting money in. So you suddenly have a fear of missing out. You're like, oh, this person or his uncle invested and this big shot invested. Now I want to get in. So there's a fear of missing out as well. So there's an interesting conflict here a little bit that happens internally because you're never going to have, you know, if you're helping a friend, I think it's a form of charity and I think support. But I think that greed and FOMO is very unique when investing in a friend and I think can blur some of the rational heuristics that you have. And what I would say is that if you have the self-awareness, understand that you are an amateur investor, I would lean much more and advise you to really be what we just talked about, you know, assuming you're going to lose the capital and have that same threshold as you would lending to a friend, pretty much. And I think if you're more sophisticated and you have seen lots of different opportunities and you're able to compare them, then I would advise you to be okay with leaning in and doubling down on that.
Okay. So let's say if some experience investing in friends and families, how does one become a VC? How do you get into the scene? Like, do you need a huge sum of money?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one way to do it, right? I mean, if you have millions of dollars, you can be a VC.
Just
or
say,
super
I
angel.
Want to invest. People look for you.
I mean, you know, that's the way of the world, right? I mean, right. You know, then the real estate developers look for you.
Everyone
insurance agents look for you.
Old friends
your
from
private,
schools.
Your old school friends, your private wealth manager comes for you. So, I mean, the truth of the matter is that once you have millions of dollars, you can be a VC or you can be a public markets investor or trader, right? So I think there's so many ways to, you know, put your money to work once you have that. So yeah, I think that's one way to be a VC.
I just saw this description for a course. I think it's an online class and then they meet up like several times a week. And yeah, it's part of becoming a VC, right? So they teach you how to assess and all that. I guess that's one way of getting your foot in the door. I'm just wondering, like, let's say you're sick of the public market. You just want to become a VC and, you know, get into, you know, rooms with pitches and then decide what to invest in. How does somebody get into that?
Yeah. Well, there are two major paths. The first major path, of course, is join a venture capital firm, right? And so these are companies that are always looking for bright, hungry talent who is passionate about, you know, technology, right? And willing to look at it from a deal perspective. And what that means is that they're always looking for junior talents, associates, analysts, or other teammates in the middle or back office. And those are great opportunities for you to join as a fresh graduate or, you know, a career switcher to be able to join and get exposure to that, right? Of course, the tricky part is that these organizations are selective. So you have to do the legwork in terms of having the expertise, having shown that you're hungry for a job, being able to demonstrate that you're able to source close and do the correct due diligence and judgment on a deal, which maybe take up the form of investment memos that you write or public thought leadership that you do. So these are the ways that you kind of like show that you're hireable by these things. And once you come in, then the pathway, they'll help you get there, right? Which is, if they identify that you are good, they promote you. If they identify that you're not so good, then they'll ask you to stay longer and learn more, or you end up switching to a different career or a different VC fund. The other path, frankly, is to be a founder, right? And if you're a founder and you're part of that 5% that does well and builds a $1 billion company or even a $100 million company, then the truth of the matter, like you said, is it goes back to path one, path zero, which is have millions of dollars, having money, and then you can do it yourself. But also, I think all the VC funds and all everybody else is looking for that kind of talent to come in to switch, because you know you want to take a break, or it's no longer your season to be building and operating, but you want to invest in the next generation of founders out there. And because you have that hands-on experience yourself as a founder, you're not only better able to understand what it takes to build a business, you also be more helpful to the founder who's building a business to therefore increase the odds of their success. And also you have better judgment because you know what are the real levers for success from your perspective in that vertical and in that stage. So I think that's how you can do it. One is have millions of dollars. Mm. Two is join a VC fund by demonstrating that you have the hunger and passion to do that. Or thirdly is be a founder yourself, and then after you complete a successful exit, transition to VC. Yeah.
Do you think having founded businesses makes you a better VC? Is it good to have? Is it a must have?
So I'll get a little more advanced here. The short answer is that if you did a quantitative analysis of founder operator experience to investor experience at a macro level, on average, there's no difference. In other words, it is not an advantage in aggregate to be a founder operator at the early or late stage across when you average that out. That being said, if you actually zoom in closer, a founder and operator experience is correlated with a different strategy, right? So just like in the markets, right? There are multiple strategies to win in the market, and the returns come out to negative, and if you're an active fund manager, on average. But the truth is there are top quartile funds, second quartile funds, and they are both outperforming the market. But on average, everybody's underperforming.
If you don't lose money, you're actually outperforming.
Yeah, exactly, right? Right. So I think what we see is that founder and operators tend to be more on the early stage. So they're focusing, for example, on pre-seed, seed, series A, maybe even series B. And they tend to be associated with more active help. So they were looking at scouting talent that is not necessarily the most strongest right now or the hottest, but has the capability and the patience to coach them and help them get to the next level. So there's a lot of hair in the deal, as they say. So there's a lot of things that doesn't feel right, but with the right help and coaching and expertise, we can kind of get you there. Whereas I think a more classic investor mindset tends to be correlated with later stage deals, Series B, Series C, Series D, Series E. And these are growth equity stages where primarily you're analyzing these companies based on their financial models, because they already achieved product market fit. They've already raised $20 million. If the founder already has coaching and is ready to rock and roll. So you're not really there to coach the founder anymore or figure out whether it's product market fit. You're really there to give them the jet fuel to there. And so having more experience in capital markets and liquidity is more helpful for this later stage of capital. So that is how I think founder and operator experience helps you. I think it helps you be a better investor, especially in early stage startups. But it's has an opportunity cost associated with having the investment banking or deal maker expertise that you need for later stage growth rounds.
Yeah, because it's all different skill sets. I mean, running a business, you could be a good businessman, but you might not be a good allocator of capital. And being able to identify good businesses to invest in and to help the founders, it's all different skill sets.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you so much.
Hey, I hope you've learned something useful today, and I truly appreciate that you took time off to better your life with the Financial Coconuts. Knowledge is that much more powerful and interesting when shared, debated, and discussed. Join our community Telegram group, follow us on our socials, sign up for our weekly newsletter. Everything is in the description.
If you love us and want to help us grow, definitely share the podcast with your friends and on your socials. For more information, check out thefinancialcoconut.com. With that, have a great day ahead. Stay tuned next week. And remember, personal finance can be chill, clear and sustainable for all.
What has been your best and worst investment? And I think this question is very interesting for you because you're a VC. And what, the investment need not be financial?
Yeah. I think the worst investment I've made was, I think in a, unfortunately, and I think a startup where there were two co-founders, just a strong team. And I think just had a really, I think strong conviction around them as a team. And I think it was a really a big moonshot about what was technology to be building. And I think at a deep level, I just knew that the business model was going to be very difficult for the go-to-market. But I just liked them so much as people that I just went in. And I think I just didn't give that enough weight, honestly. And so long story short was, you know, it went to zero. But I think worse than that, frankly, was that I think they kind of closed without informing me, right? So I had to find out via LinkedIn announcement of one of the employees. And I was like, okay, I didn't get a heads up. I didn't get a transition. Okay. And so I don't think it was bad because I think I invested in the team because I felt like it was going to be important for society. And I didn't actually have an issue of losing the capital because, again, I put a capital in an amount that I expected to lose at some level. So I don't think it was an issue in that way. But I think it was just disappointing that the founders didn't communicate that in a formal way, right? Or give me a heads up about the issues there. And so I wasn't able to help. But also, I also felt like I wasn't in the loop, right? And I think that was the worst investment, not necessarily just in terms of capital, because it went to zero, which I expect most of my investments to do. But also because it just left, you know, a sad taste in my mouth, right? Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think best investment I've made, I think I'm happy to share too. I think the best non-financial investment I made was in my podcast. Brave Southeast Asia Tech podcast, www.jeremyow.com. And I think it was great because, you know, I love listening to podcasts. And I remember hearing to myself at some point like, hey, all the folks I'm listening to are either like American males, so which is kind of weird. But also, I'm not hearing anything about Southeast Asia. There's nothing that's really inspirational or thoughtful about the leadership journey. And so for many years, I was just kind of like waiting for that podcast to happen. And pandemic happened and I was like stuck at home. And I was like, okay, why don't I just try this, right?
Turns out I get
to listen to the podcast while I'm making it and I get to ask the questions, right? Like just like you are. And I think it's just been tremendous to grow that to like over, you know, tens of thousands of followers and, you know, all these things. But I think it was just very nice to just be able to have that curation. And I think at the end of the day, you know, I think some people are like, oh, is the podcast about you being brave? And I always tell people, it's like, well, it's not that I am brave. It's more like the podcast is because I want to be brave and I want to interview people who I feel are brave and I want to feel braver, right? You know? And so there's an interesting dynamic there that I'm often thinking about.
And the book is a natural extension of that podcast.
Exactly, exactly. And on the financial side, I thought that another financial investment I made was what I call founder. And she is building at-home testing for pollutants in your body via urine. And so long story short, it's kind of like 23andMe equivalent for pollutants, right? So, you know, you go to the washroom, you put it in a sample, you send it off to the lab by mail, and then they kind of like do that testing for metals and plastics and things like that. And I thought it was just such an amazing thing because the truth is, the science is hard because historically, urine samples don't travel well over the mail. I mean, you go through the sun, the snow, the delay, you know, it's just, you know, it deteriorates pretty quick. So there's a science component to it. But I think what I was really inspired by was just like, you know, the fact that, you know, so many of us are getting poisoned every day by the stuff around us. And the people who are most poisoned by, you know, the toxic site or the heavy metals and so forth, your pregnant mother with a child, so forth, these are often people who have the least access to this because the truth is you can get it now. You just have to go to the doctor, get a prescription or order. Then you have to go to the lab, spend an hour waiting or 2 hours there. And then you wait for the lab results to come back in a week or whatever it is. And then you get someone to call you. And the cost of that, not just in cash, but in terms of time, basically makes it only available for the upper class, right? And so for her to really have that vision to make it 10x or 100x cheaper in terms of time and money means that so many more people and the people who are often living the closest, for example, or getting poisoned, will have the self-awareness and the knowledge to act on having too much BPA in your blood or too much heavy metal or arsenic or mercury, is amazing, right? Because then suddenly people who are unwell and have been confused about why they're unwell can take action. Regulators can take action because now they know that lots of people are getting poisoned, for example. And I just think to myself, like, you know, this is money I've put in her because I think she made a science work. But if she can really make this so much more cheaper for so many folks, I think there's a huge amount of ripple effects into the community right from there. And so I think if it makes it work, it's a great financial investment, obviously, because everybody will want to do that at home instead of traveling to a lab. But I think it would be a great social investment, actually, because I think, you know, you can imagine, you know, all the generational change, right, that happens as a result, you know, just from someone avoiding toxins will impact the child, which will impact their children, which will impact their children. I mean, I think the ripple effects are tremendous for this generation and the next seven generations.
Yeah. Seeing not just the financial aspects of it.
Yeah.
Seeing how it can help people.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Cool.
What's something under $100 that you spent on that has been a game changer for you?
Oh, so many things that, below $100, the life changer. I think the game changer for me for under $100, honestly, has been a microphone, right? A good microphone. And what I mean by that is just like,
For the podcast
initially, but, my first microphone I ever bought was under $100. And it was because that dual use of work at home and therefore eventually a podcast. But I think the world has changed dramatically over the past few years from the pandemic, right? I think before that, Zoom was kind of happening once in a while.
Mm.
And now I think, honestly, you know, on some days, like 80 or 90% of my meetings are online, right? And what I mean by that is that so much of our meetings that we would have had, the first coffee chat, et cetera, or even business travel is now happening over video conference. And I think it's a shame to, on my end, see so many founders or observe them, unfortunately, not pitching well, not because they're not passionate or not because they're not charismatic or thoughtful about the business, but because they have a bad mic, you know, a bad headset, right?
There's always,
right? It's the background noise, you know, the street is there. And it's kind of awkward reality because, you know, you and I know that if I met an investor or if I met a business partner, I would dress up nice, I would shave, I would do all these things that cost me time and money. But suddenly we go on our video call and, you know, we're not setting up right, we don't have the right lighting, we don't have the right sound. And, you know, there's a invisible tax that happens all the time because, you know, everyone's kind of like weirded out by the weird clipping noise or the weird background noise or these other things.
Yeah, and you could get a really good mic for less than $100 or about $100.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this kind of equipment used to be out of reach, but it's just so commonplace nowadays.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, they last forever, right?
Yeah, so they're good.
Unlike, you know, buying a sports jacket, et cetera, that's just going to last you 5 years, right? You know, and get stains, et cetera. A good mic can be with you for 10 or 20 years, right? You know, or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you look at that amortization or depreciation of that expense, I don't think it's a huge investment at all.
Even if you're not pitching, you're just an employee and you have to go for online meetings, well, just get a good mic and it makes you so much better.
Exactly. Yeah. Something that nerd out effect, you know, something that lets you have that cardioid pattern so that it picks up you, right? And, you know, doesn't pick up, you know, your kids, your pets, your cats, dogs, the window. I think that really gets you a great opportunity to be presentable, but also present at your best, right? And you have the confidence that you're presenting your best.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, I mean, you listen to podcasts as well. What's one place that you learn from that you would want to recommend to our listeners? It could be a podcast, a book, a website, what have you.
Now, I love this podcast called Reboot.io. And what they are is that they are a coaching agency for founders and VCs, right, in tech world. And they're based out of the US. And I had the benefit of being introduced to them because I had a great coach from them, and I still do, called Marty Janowitz. And I think he's been a tremendous executive coach over, you know, the past 4 years, right? Time flies indeed. And, you know, he's part of this, you know, he called it association, right? Of group under Jerry Colonna, who's also a former venture capitalist. And he's built this tremendous platform called Reboot.io. And that podcast really goes into him having these one-on-one coaching, but also deep and vulnerable conversations with these titans, right? Mm. Or to-be titans, or crashed out of titans, founders and VCs. And I think that vulnerability is there. I think there was a tremendous episode recently about, and all the coaches kind of gathered to talk a little bit about a midlife crisis, and they were talking about how, folks often encounter midlife crisis because, they realize that they get to choose for the second half of their life what they didn't get to choose for the first half of their life. Because, so much of it was predetermined by their school, by their teachers, by their parents.
Family.
Mm-hmm. And so that, the awareness of the mortality of your life kind of like backfills today. And you're like, okay, now I have to choose, or I should choose, and I get to choose. And that dodging of that responsibility creates that crisis moment. And I just felt like they had such great books, they had such great feedback. And, what I got away from that episode, for example, was there are so many rites and rituals that are associated from us to 0 to 35, right? And what I mean by that is, if you go back 5 generations ago, you were lucky to live till 35, right? I mean, basically that meant that you don't
have a life long enough for a midlife crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Your midlife crisis was like 18. 16 or 18, right? For them, right? Yeah. And so, it literally life was, geared around, to be 35, man, you're successful because you not only became 35, but you probably got to have a kid at the age of 16 or 18 and then raise that kid to 16 or 18 yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so much of our societal beliefs, our rites, our rituals, around parenting, around school, university, graduation, marriage, all these things are really geared, if you think about it, to provide rites and rituals and ceremonies for that first 35 years of your life. And then once you hit 35 or 40 and your kids are kind of like, graduating or something like that, then suddenly you're like, you're out of runway, right? You're suddenly out of the structure of society. And so you suddenly had to have the privilege, but the terrifying thing where you get to pick the life that your ancestors never got to choose, right? I mean, my grandfather died because he was a lumberjack and he didn't get medical care in his mid-30s. And so now I'm as old as he is. Isn't that crazy? And he died because he couldn't afford medical care and a tree fell on him. But I get to suddenly now today get to pick an unlived life that he didn't get to have. Mm. And the truth is, it's a huge responsibility. And I think that's why I think it makes, a difficult journey for everybody to choose. But also I think it's a worthwhile privilege that you should choose as well as you can get because very few people across history ever got to choose this for millions of years since the start of humankind as a species. But also if you look at the world today, not a lot of people don't get to choose that either. I mean, half the world doesn't get to choose the same way you get to have a midlife crisis. And so
that's an interesting perspective on why we have a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
You get to choose how the rest of your life looks like.
Yeah, it's an opportunity.
It's an opportunity and
it's a
burden.
It's a midlife opportunity, yeah. Right? Because, congratulations, you get to pick a bonus life, of 35 or 75 years or even, with the way science and healthcare is going, we could live to 120, 130, right? Yeah. And so, the concept of retirement age of 70 or 75 or 80 is bonkers because
living longer.
Yeah, people don't know what to do with it, understandably, because
we've never lived that long.
Lived that long, right?
Yeah.
Think about it. Is that crazy? Like, like 70 years ago, 2 generations ago, effectively, we were in the middle of a war, right? It was just lucky to live, right? And now we have the privilege to live and be living in peace. So it's bonkers,
Right. So these are the things that get you thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's good to listen to more podcasts, read more books.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you so much.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.